Hello, I'm Sarah Kanoski. I'm with you for just a few more days. Richard Feidler will be back with you later in the week. But before he is, we thought we'd bring you some of the conversations that got the biggest response last time I was in Richard's chair. Today, it's Michael Dillon. Michael has shared a climbing rope with Sir Edmund Hillary. He's shared a tent with a Yeti. He's jet-boated up the Ganges. And all of this he's caught on film. Michael Dillon is a pioneer cinematographer in adventure and mountain documentaries. He's taken his camera to some of the most remarkable and remote places on Earth. And along with the adrenaline, Michael has seen the tragic side of these expeditions too. Welcome to Conversations, Michael.
Thank you, Sarah.
Tell me, when did you first see Mount Everest?
Well, I saw it on film in my early youth. Drive-in cinemas was the place to go to. And the film about the first successful attempt, Conquest of Everest, was actually the first film ever shown in a drive-in theatre in Australia.
Really?
So I went along at the age of 10. It was one of the first films I'd ever seen. And there was an amazing adventure unfolding. These guys, after all these attempts, had finally climbed Everest, and I was climbing with them, and I wanted to go there myself.
Is that what struck you, the kind of human element, or was it the grandeur of that mountain scenery?
Well, I think it was because in those days there wasn't much actual talking. That whole film had no dialogue between all the people. It was just images, but they were enough to really make you want to go there.
And so when did you actually go to Everest for the first time?
I was in my early 20s, and I had, like many people, wanted to go to Nepal, but it was almost cut off. It was the first tourists really went there in the early 1960s. And then towards the end of the 1960s, an Australian guy called Warwick Deacock, in conjunction with somebody in Nepal, started trekking, the actual business of trekking to the Himalayan peaks. And I went along on, I think it was the second trip. And so I was one of the first Australians to actually walk into the Everest region.
So this is the 1960s point. What was it like to walk in?
Oh, it was pretty special. Of course, we, as the first Australians, they didn't really know where Australia was. They knew all about New Zealand. There's an Edmund Hillary, a New Zealander, a new hospital built by New Zealanders, a new school in their village built by New Zealanders. And I think to them, New Zealand comprised about three quarters of the world map. So we had to be very polite and say, well, Australia's just a little island next to New Zealand.
I think that would have made the New Zealanders very happy that you were there with.
Yeah.
And so this is just at the start of the whole trekking industry. Were you walking with Sherpas?
We were. We were walking with Sherpas, and we went right up to Everest Base Camp, and it was only 15 years before that it had been climbed, so that was pretty special.
And so what was there at base camp then?
Nothing. There's mostly nothing there except for a very busy time around April, May, when the expeditions happen. Otherwise, it's a great big jumble of glacier and wonderful views looking up at Everest.
Did you get your hands on a camera at all in that first trip?
Well, the leader, Warwick Deacock, was actually commissioned by the ABC to take a bit of movie footage of our trip, but he succumbed to altitude sickness, and it was a bit like Monty Python sketch. He was being carried down by the Sherpas on a stretcher, but he was still trying to film. He's a big, tough army guy, and he was still trying to film from his stretcher. The Sherpas didn't really like this because they were happy to carry him, but they didn't want to carry him plus his camera. So I was given his camera, and for the first time I used a real movie camera.
And could you know how to do it straight away? How did you know?
It was fairly simple. I just had to wind it up every now and again to make sure it kept working, and I tried to frame it well. And some of it was used on the ABC.
And was that a thrill, seeing your film?
It was. It inspired me to, in the end, buy my own camera
and
keep going.
Where did you get that from, your first camera?
I bought it from Skippy the Bush Kangaroo, not himself, but the series. they'd finished the series and they wanted to sell off some of their cameras, and so I bought one. Very expensive in those days, about $2,000 it cost me. And so I had my own camera, and I then wanted to do something with it. And, of course, I was thinking naturally to try and go back to the Himalayas and do something there.
And so when did you get back to the Himalayas? Was that the first place that you did your own film?
I just wanted to go to another part of Nepal and actually do a proper documentary about trekking in the Himalayas. So again with Warwick Deacock, who was the one who got sick on the first trip, he led an expedition to the Annapurna region, and I went along with my big heavy camera and a big tripod over my shoulder and battery, pretty heavy sort of a lot of stuff to carry around all
How
the time.
How heavy were those cameras?
They were heavy in those days. They were like bricks. And then we had a friend who did the sound that was separate to the camera. The trouble is, disaster struck on the second day. The most important thing I really had in terms of equipment was my light meter. It was one of those things with like a half ping pong ball, and it was critical to have that because the latitude of the film was such that if you got the exposure wrong by just one stop, it was either totally too dark or totally too light. And then I sat on this light meter.
Oh, no.
And that was a big problem, except somebody actually used their thumbs to push it all back into shape and I could keep going.
And did you manage to sell that footage or what happened to
it? Well, we finished the film and it was actually cheaper to finish it in London than it was in Sydney at the time. And so it was really exciting to go through the whole business of finishing off a film, you know, writing the script and doing all the sound things. And finally there it was in its nice shiny blue container. And I took it by bicycle to the BBC and they bought it.
A good start then to your career.
Yeah.
Were you just teaching yourself, Michael?
I was really. There was no film school and I was just learning by my mistakes, really, zooming too much. And but yeah, I was learning, but obviously I got good enough material anyway to make a full documentary.
Had there been much footage done of this part of the
world?
No, there
hadn't.
Filming?
I think that helped me because trekking was still in its infancy and no one had made a proper film about trekking in the Himalayas.
And how did you come to work with Sir Edmund Hillary?
I read an article in the paper, Sydney paper actually, that he was planning this amazing expedition up the River Ganges in jet boats. And then at the very bottom of the article, it actually said that he's looking for a film crew. And I thought, well, I may as well write to him. I at least could say that I had done one film in the Himalayas. And I did write to him, and I eventually got the job.
And what did that involve? Did you go and meet him? Was there an interview, or you just got a very happy letter?
Yeah, I was at the time I was going to New Zealand anyway because I was roadshowing my first Himalayan film, and I met him there, and we got on well, and he, despite my inexperience and so on, I got the job of filming it.
And was he a big hero for you at that point, Michael?
Oh, he was. It wasn't just the fact that he was, in a sense, the star of that first film that I'd ever seen. Then Hillary's wife started to write books about all the family's adventures that the Hillary family had up in the Himalayas. And I know, and I desperately wanted to. I wish I was Hillary's son, you know, Peter Hillary doing all these wonderful things up in the Everest Red region. And so for many reasons, it was just amazing that I was able to actually be on one of his expeditions.
And so what was the plan? It was to start at the Ganges.
The aim was to, these are the New Zealand boats which don't have propellers, they outboard engine motors, they've actually just propelled by jets of water coming out the back, so they can go up very, very shallow stretches of water. But the plan was to start at the very mouth of the Ganges and just go as far as they could. They knew that the Ganges comes from the Himalayas and there's a very, very difficult water to it. But we're going to try and go as far as we possibly could.
So travel up the Ganges on the jet
boats. Up the Ganges, three boats, yes, yeah.
And how old was Edmund Hillary?
He would have been, at that stage, about 58 years old.
What kind of animals, what kind of, habitat were you travelling through at the beginning?
Well, the beginning we were travelling through the Mangrove Delta. And animals, you wouldn't think any would live there, but tigers live there.
Tigers?
The tigers used to live all over India, but then they've been pushed to these little very inhospitable corners, even mangrove deltas, where they've got to kind of live on brackish water and eat fish, and even fishermen. They eat about 50 fishermen a year. So it's a pretty hard life for everybody
down
there, including
the fishermen and
including
the tigers.
And we were told there were about 200 tigers in this whole area. We weren't expecting to see any, but and we had to be a bit cautious. But
and did you see?
We saw a something in the middle of one of the mangrove deltas. We were going up. And then we got a bit closer, it was striped, black and white, yellow and white, black stripes. And it was a tiger swimming from one side of the bank to the other. And we were just followed as closely as we could, and it went to the bank. And it was just amazing to actually see. We actually saw two.
You saw two? Wow. Mm. Whereabouts would you sleep? I mean, were the boats big enough to sleep on?
No, we'd always find a good place on the bank near a village or all the way up. We did this at night, just find a good place on the bank, often away from people, and just camped out like everybody else.
What kind of reception were you getting from the people who lived along the river?
Well, we even knew that the press were interested in the right from the beginning. When we saw the tigers, all the headlines of the papers were saying, even the tigers have come out to see Sir Hilary. And as we got towards Calcutta, it was amazing. You could hardly see the banks for people. It was a huge, like a royal progress all the way up the river, especially through all the towns.
He was such a hero.
He was also doing the ultimate pilgrimage, to go a pilgrimage up the Ganges, and also the curiosity about these new strange boats.
How did Edmund Hillary deal with all of this adulation and attention?
Well, it was hard because whenever he came ashore, he was totally surrounded by autograph hunters. They're almost lethal profession. So many. Not just that, people wanted to touch him, because if he's doing this very important pilgrimage, just to touch the person doing it, it transfers some spiritual power to them. So he was, in a sense, in danger, but he took it all very well. We also had a problem at every lunchtime, because the boats would be refueled at lunchtime, and so the opportunity was, in any town, a local service club would vie for the honour of having Sir Hilary for lunch. And there was one time, I think the Rotary, in one town, the Rotary got the honour of having him for lunch, but that enraged the Lions, and they stormed into the Rotary luncheon.
Intestine battle between the charity groups of rural India. Mm. How far up the river did you manage to get on these boats?
We got all the way up the flatter section of the Ganges. We had problems sometimes. We'd go aground because it's very hard to tell the depth of the Ganges. It's so brown that we'd often sort of come to a sudden halt. But then we got to where the Ganges leaves the Himalayas, and then the rapids start. And we had about a week or 10 days of trying to get our boats as far as up those rapids as we could.
And then you started walking?
We started walking because our aim was then to go to a Himalayan peak to symbolically end our journey, is where the Ganges, the water from the Ganges begin.
And what happened to Edmund Hillary on those peaks, Michael?
The last part of that climb was quite a big long day. And because I was the least experienced climber, I got the job. I actually got on his rope.
Wow.
Which is pretty special.
That is pretty special.
So he led me up that to our final camp. But when we all woke up the next morning, he didn't wake up. People went to his tent and they realised he was almost semi-conscious. And they knew what it was. It was altitude sickness and cerebral fluid on the brain. They also knew that could kill you very quickly.
He would have been on higher peaks than this, obviously. I mean, he didn't get altitude sickness on Everest.
No, he didn't, but he did get it on a couple of other peaks after Everest. It can happen to anybody. Even though he was 58, he was still carrying as much or more than anyone else.
And so it's something you can get even if you haven't had it before. It's something that can strike you on one mountain and not another.
Yeah. It's pretty fairly unpredictable.
So how dangerous was that scenario when he wasn't waking up?
It's extremely dangerous. When you have fluid on the brain and that kind of altitude sickness, you can die very quickly. And the only way to get out of the situation is to get down quickly. We didn't have oxygen with us. So what they did was, and he had all his best mates, best New Zealand climbers around him. So he had to basically, he was wrapped in his tent. You know, they just kept him in his tent and they started to haul his tent down with him in it, down
and,
the mountain.
And he was still unconscious at this point?
He was still pretty bad. And Peter was there, and of course Peter, his son, was had lost his mother just 2 years before.
In that terrible and plane crash.
Yeah, yeah. So he was desperately trying, hauling down as much as, you know, as anyone. And it was, my job was to get all the extra gear and a big rucksack on my back and follow them down. And we got down a fair way in the time. And he did slowly get better.
So it's something that as you start to descend from altitude,
yeah, the air thickens, you get more oxygen in the air, and he did. He wasn't too good, but he was able to be lifted out by helicopter, which was a great relief.
Absolutely, and he, and from that, he made a full recovery.
After a while, yes, yeah.
Did you work with him again after this, with Edmund Hillary again, Michael?
Yes, after that, I did a lot of filming with him in Nepal because his life's work had become the fact that after Everest, he'd asked the Sherpas what they could he could possibly do for them. And they said they'd like a school for their children. And he built one. And then the people from the next valley said, I'd like one too. So he built another one. And in those decades that followed Everest, he'd built, in the end, about 28 schools. And I was filming him in those years, building, doing this work. And I continued filming him, actually, until he was about 80 years old, still doing this work. And that it wasn't just schools. He built 2 hospitals, airstrips, bridges.
And what sort of relationship did you form with him?
Oh, it's a pretty strong one. I was very lucky to have had this start, and then he kept liking the fact that I was making good films with him, so we've ended up doing about 5 films.
He had a reputation as a person of humility. Did you see that?
Yeah, he did. As he got older, of course, and was walking around the Everest region, a lot of trekkers kind of didn't recognise him. They probably wondered why this old guy, what this old guy was doing in their territory, and I'd be with him sitting in tea shops and the trekkers would be kind of boasting about their achievements and he'd just sit there saying nothing. And one day I was filming him talking to his son Peter on a rock and Ed Hillary was just casually holding an ice axe as they talked. And an American trekker came up and I just noticed him watching what we were doing. And then he suddenly couldn't contain himself anymore. He suddenly interrupted and said to Hillary, hey, bud, that's not the proper way to hold an ice axe. and of course, being such a humble guy, Hillary said nothing. He just let him instruct him how to hold an ice axe properly. And the guy went away not knowing who he'd instructed.
How could you keep your mouth shut at that point, Michael?
I don't know.
I would have run after him, I think.
That's a true story, and it's typical of him. He was just kind of he was a great man without the great man syndrome.
And what sense did you get from him about why these kind of expeditions were important? I mean, why do them?
We did a number of expeditions where even a younger generation, the kids who were the sons and daughters of these best climbing friends, like 3 generations, we went to Fiji, we went to India, and he was really keen on the fact that everybody should be doing these kind of things. He kind of said it's not the size of the adventure that matters, it's the important thing is that you have them.
And why?
I just think that from my own early age, I've been doing these outdoor things and they mean so much to me.
In what sort of way? What's it done for you having these adventures?
I think that you're really out there, you're really in the world. You kind of know that, I guess you then start thinking about how important it is to preserve this world and how beautiful it is out there. And there's no better way of getting out, going to these remote places and seeing the world as it really is.
Did you go to Edmund Hillary's funeral?
Yeah, that was a pretty special event. His coffin was lying in state for several days before the funeral, and many, many people were filing filing pass. And on the day before, the night before his funeral, it was announced that the church will be open all night. And I think that just about every family in every living room in Auckland suddenly said, "Look, we've got to go. Nobody else like him." And these huge queues formed down the streets of Auckland, going towards the cathedral. And I remember walking down at about 11 o'clock at night, and there was way down the queue. There's a whole Indian family, a little boy with a big white flower. And maybe we'd had to wait another hour to actually get to file past their hero. And the same thing was happening in Nepal. Every school that Hillary built had a little oxygen cylinder school bell. And so on the day of his funeral, all the Nepalese kids were ringing those oxygen cylinder school bells.
Amazing to think that you'd made such a contribution to his work in terms of the films. What's the first film you ever made, Michael?
I was still at school, and I don't know what, maybe a film we saw at school inspired me to, well, my handicap was I was about 12 years old and I didn't actually have a camera. So I got these long strips of paper and started at one end by putting in frames, and with my Derwent pencil I started to make a film about the history of the earth. I started with the first caveman woman, Ugun Goo, and it went right through the history of the earth to the present day.
Nothing if not ambitious.
Well, I obviously must have wanted at an early age to make films.
And who did you show it to, or did you show it to anyone?
I had this great long strip of paper, which was the film. So I made myself a little Meccano cinema, and I wound the film through and charged my parents a penny each to look at it. Not my sister, because she had to read the script that I'd written.
It was an excellent start for your filmmaking career. Michael, what about there were other expeditions, other climbers that you followed to Mount Everest. The first Australian team that attempted to climb in 1984, what was unique about that team?
Well, it was unique in the sense that why should anybody from the world's flattest continent want to climb Everest? And the most extraordinary thing is that you'd think they'd choose an easy route, but this team, just five guys, chose the hardest thing ever done on Everest. The five of them weren't going to use bottled oxygen, and they were going to try a new steep route that hadn't been climbed.
Now, is this crazy or is this courageous?
It's both. There were another few things about that expedition which were extraordinary. They were all vegetarians. There was no real leader. And there was almost no argument, and they kind of just quietly went about doing the impossible.
And so, did they do it?
What they did do it, but after many mishaps along the way.
And were you filming the whole journey that this Australian team took?
Yes, we started from the Tibetan side, so we had to. It was quite hard to get to Everest at that time. We had to cross the Brahmaputra River in a yak hide boat. So it was even getting to the mountain was harder than it is today.
And there was an avalanche somewhere in that trip.
While the guys were preparing the route, they used to ski to the base of the face. They were climbing the face of Everest, and they'd take off their skis and boots, ski boots, and start getting into their climbing clothes. And then they climbed to a certain height, then went back and skied back to camp. So one day we came back and found that all the gear they'd left at the base of the face had been avalanched on.
On air, online, and on your mobile. This is Conversations on ABC Radio. You can subscribe to our podcast. It's easy and it's free. Go to abc.net.au/conversations.
This is Conversations. My guest is Michael Dillon, who's a pioneering cinematographer of adventure and mountain documentaries. I'm feeling a little bit jealous, Michael, I have to say, as I'm just looking over your CV here. Describing this first trip of first attempt by Australians to get to the summit of Mount Everest, so their gear was buried, or what happened?
Yeah, very important gear. We went to the base of the face and there was nothing left. There was just avalanche debris. This is ice axes, climbing boots, all
everything.
Key things. And so we had to start digging a hole to try and find it. And we ended up digging up over several days, so probably the world's highest hole. It's about 21,000 feet altitude, about 4 feet deep, and digging up with our spades, which was really hard work.
Hard work because of the altitude?
The altitude, yeah. You could hardly move from one place to another. It was so hard work. And we were also kind of digging our own graves because this hole was right, there was 9,000 feet of Everest above us. And there could have been another avalanche and with us in it as well as the gear. But we never found it. So what happened was that the film crew started to lend important gear to the climbers, and the climbers could keep going.
So they went on, but you couldn't follow them because
we weren't going to actually follow them too high because those five were climbing without oxygen, and they had their own agenda, and they're better climbers than us anyway. We didn't want to interfere with their schedule, so we were always at a certain point going back to film on telephoto lenses and gave them little cameras themselves to take to the summit.
And Tim McCartney Snape was one who made it to the summit, the first Australian, I'm assuming.
Yeah, Greg Mortimer and Tim McCartney Snape made it to the summit. And Tim had energy to spare. He got out a little tape recorder and did this amazing 10-minute speech about how beautiful the world looked from up here and how crazy we'd be to try and destroy it with nuclear weapons. Very lucid speech. And so when he got back down, I kind of asked him, if Everest was a bit higher, do you still think you could have climbed it? And he said, yeah, maybe he could. And then I introduced that idea I had to him, the ultimate climb. What about, you can't climb higher than the summit of Everest, but what if you started lower? Because Everest is measured from sea level, and what if you start there?
So this was your idea for the next project?
I'd had the idea, and it seemed like, from a filmmaker's point of view, a great one to start at the Bay of Bengal in India and try and walk, climb Everest from there, and, 1,000 kilometres actually from the summit, and try see if it's humanly possible to actually do that and still have energy left to get that first that final footstep on the summit.
And what was Tim's response?
Maybe he was a bit tired at that stage.
So this is on Everest, you asked him?
No, I didn't ask him. It was a few months later. We were actually trekking in the Himalayas of Dick Smith, and Dick was there when I actually put this idea to Tim. And he said to us, he said to him and Tim, well, look, if you're crazy enough to do this, I'll be crazy enough to fund it. So Dick did fund it, and we set off to do it.
So what happens? You begin walking at the Bay of Bengal.
Yes.
Yeah, and are you walking as well?
I was walking too, carrying a camera. And then maybe it was 3 weeks of just walking 30 kilometres a day through the flat part of India. Then we got to the Ganges, and then Tim was a real purist. There was no bridges anywhere nearby, and he had to do all this under his own steam. Couldn't go by boat or anything.
This was the idea that you do it all under your own steam.
Yeah, to do it under his own steam, totally. And so he had to swim across the Ganges.
You're kidding me.
Yeah. He kept his mouth shut for various obvious reasons. But
how wide is the Ganges?
Well, it probably, if you added up, there were three separate channels, but probably adding it up to about a kilometre in all.
Please tell me you didn't swim as well.
No, I went by boat.
Much more sensible. So he swims and he manages to keep going up through India.
We got to the Nepalese border after maybe going 600 kilometres of walking, and then he found he couldn't get through that border. They wouldn't let foreigners through, only Indians.
Even foreigners who'd walked and swum to
get
there.
We tried for several days, but no, we didn't know about the rule of no foreigners. So the next, that meant he had to divert 280 kilometres to a border post we could get through. And because of our schedule, there's the key time of the year to climb Everest, he had to run that bit. He ran about a marathon and a half a day for several days to finally get to the other border post. And then, of course, when we got to Nepal, we still had a long way to go.
You still had to climb Everest. This is part of
climbing the whole of Mount Everest, yeah.
And so then you get into, you get to base camp, and does he make the final climb?
We got to base camp, and then you can't just immediately start climbing. You've got to spend maybe a month or so, just your body getting a bit of extra red corpuscles and so on to acclimatise better.
I can't imagine that he was resting during this time, Michael. From what you described,
he
was probably doing push-ups.
No,
or,
what happens is you tend to go up to certain heights, and he was actually trying to work out which route he would take up Everest. He didn't want to go up the normal way. One day he'd be climbing up great sort of rock walls to the North Col and trying it up there, and it was just amazing. He was almost until the last minute, he hadn't decided exactly which route he was taking.
And did you feel that you had sort of tethered yourself to a lunatic, or were you full of admiration?
Well, I'd seen him climb, in the few years before, and I knew that he was a fantastic climber. But anything can happen on Everest, and we were all extremely worried until we actually, the moment he was actually on the summit.
And did you go with him to the summit?
No, we again for the same reason. He's such a good climber. And also he had the extra energy to take a little camera himself. So I went as high as I could, which was like halfway through the icefall, without endangering his progress or slowing him up. And then I stood back and with my big telephoto lens, and he took over in an amazing way, considering he again was climbing without bottled oxygen.
And he made it safely up and back.
He made it, yes, he did.
And was it on that trip, Michael, that you thought you had a Yeti in your tent?
Yes. I'd better explain a little bit about Yetis. They actually, when you ask a Sherpa to describe one, it's almost exactly the same as a male orangutan. And they have slightly more pointed heads. But then there's another kind of gorilla that has a pointed head. So and because many, many mountain people from one end of the Himalayas to the other describe pretty well the same thing, we can just assume that there was another form of great ape once there, or possibly, it would be nice to think, is still there in the forest somewhere. But I was in my tent at base camp one day during that expedition, and one night, and I felt that there was something in there with me, and I felt out, and there was a big, very big furry thing, and I put my hand about 2 feet further along, and it was still there. There was more of it. It was pretty big. It was almost filling the tent, and I thought, this is. I just was trying to find a torch or a camera to film this amazing thing.
That's the difference between you and me. I'm just be screaming and looking for the zip, but you're looking for your camera.
Well, anyway, then the Yeti barked. So it was one of the huge big Tibetan dogs that come up to base camp every climbing season to get the good food.
Are they dangerous, those dogs that are around?
Tibetan mastiffs are very good watchdogs, but these ones were pretty friendly. They had to be, because they joined up to each expedition to be, in a sense, be mascots and have a bit of dog therapy, and they know they'd be well fed for the duration of the expedition.
You then did some work with a father and son climbing team from New Zealand. Who was that?
After, I guess I was always thinking of another idea for an Everest documentary, and I'd read that an Australian boy had climbed Mount Cook with his dad at the age of 11, and that he and his dad planned to do what they call the seven summits, that, in other words, you climb the highest mountain on each continent. And so the boy climbed Kilimanjaro at the age of 12.
Gosh.
And then I joined up with them to film the ongoing process of trying to climb the highest mountain. So he climbed Elbrus in Russia, the highest in Europe, then Mount McKinley, the highest in North America. And by the time he was 15, he climbed the highest in South America, which is almost 7,000 metres. And then it was time for him to attempt Everest.
Did he remind you of you as a kid?
I think so. I mean, that was one of the things I liked, that he was a dad who sort of encouraged his son to really enjoy the outdoors and to have outdoor experiences. And of course, I was a bit worried, who's driving this? Is it the father or the son? But when we climbed Elbrus, the highest in Europe, it was an extremely hard day. I remember we got to the summit about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and there was a 7-hour descent down to back to camp. and we're absolutely exhausted at the end of that day. And just before, when we got there, we were just so tired, we just went straight to bed. And then I heard that he was 13 years old at the time saying, just said, I just wish every day it was like today. So he got that was his hardest day of his life, but was yet the best day of his life. So I kind of liked the fact that he did that, and he kept going on, and as I said, by the age of 15, we set off to climb Everest.
And who did you ask to come with you on that Everest journey?
I wasn't sure of my abilities to film, be the sole camera crew. The aim was that I would go with the father and son to the summit, but I wasn't. Things can happen on Everest, and I wasn't sure whether I alone should be the film crew. So Lincoln Hall, who was with me on Everest in 1984, came along as an additional cameraman.
And what happened during that ascent for Richard and Christopher Harris?
We got to the final stage of the expedition. We'd done all the usual things of going up to certain heights without oxygen and coming down. So the boy had got up to 7,300 metres without oxygen, just 1,500 metres below the summit. But when we did the final climb, both the father and the son, for various reasons, fell ill. And my job then was to follow them down to base camp to continue that story, because that was the story, the trip, the father and the son. But therefore Lincoln we were all going to have a Sherpa each to help us on our final summit climb. So Lincoln, we just said to Lincoln, look, why take all our Sherpas and go up and have a go at climbing it yourself.
Because had he made it in 1984?
He hadn't. He, on an earlier mountain, he'd got frostbite and was very sensitive to the fact that he could well get it again. In 1984, he made the decision to not go for the summit because he knew he'd be still climbing at night.
And did he reach the summit on this trip?
He did. It was not many people climb with three personal Sherpas. So when we heard that 9 o'clock in the morning he'd actually reached the summit, it was fantastic. Here he was, 50 years old, he'd finally got his dream of reaching the summit.
How do you even hear that? Is there like a radio?
He radioed from the summit, speaking totally lucidly, 9 o'clock in the morning,
he must have been
sunny
stunning
day, three Sherpas with him. What could go wrong?
And what did go wrong?
Not long after that, we didn't know for quite some time. There was another incident on the same expedition we were part of a big Russian expedition. One of the other climbers climbing with Lincoln turned to his guide and said, "I'm dying," and he died. And we
just
heard,
dropped dead.
Yeah, just dropped dead on the way down. And we heard this, and suddenly our expedition leader, who was in a camp above us, because we'd gone down to the lowest camp, said we had assumed Lincoln was on his way down, everything was fine, but he said, well, to the that Lincoln was dying too, and I mean that was terrible news for us. That apparently what was happening was that sometime after the summit, something had gone wrong. Maybe he developed a kind of cerebral edema. He was acting irrationally, not wanting to go anywhere. This had been going on for some hours. And the Sherpas had all, the three Sherpas were, three of them, luckily there were three, were really struggling to get him to go anywhere down, or he wanted to go sideways or stay where he was.
So as he was starting to make the descent, this altitude sickness or some...
Yeah, it can happen.
Must have just kicked in.
It can happen with you, even if you change cylinders, you're on oxygen and suddenly you change cylinders. We don't know what happened, but it happened and it does happen. And we were really worried for him because this never ends well, this cerebral edema, especially at that height.
Could you speak to him? Were you in contact with him?
Well, that was the frustrating thing. There was some radio contact, but Lincoln didn't want to talk to anyone, and the Sherpas were just so busy trying to get him to move. But finally, we did hear him, Lincoln's voice, maybe 6 hours afterwards, maybe 4 o'clock in the afternoon, that he sort of said, I've just opened an eyeball. And then a little while later, he said to us, there's a rescue underway. And he was clear enough to know there was some kind of rescue going on. But we just tried all we had very few opportunities to actually talk to him. We were desperate to do so because, you know, we were so far away from him. The only way we could help was to try and rescue him with our voice and say the right things. And we did try and say all the right things about his family. And
So you're just trying to sort of reach, get some kind of conscious reaction from someone who's suffering altitude sickness,
yes.
Are you?
One of the Sherpas with him could speak pretty good English. And the good thing was also that Lincoln has spent a lot of time in the Everest region and has got to know the language, and he was a director like me of the Australian Himalayan Foundation. So the Sherpas, of course, they give 100% anyway, but they were giving 120%. They really liked this guy, and they were doing all they possibly could to get him down.
Was it dangerous for those Sherpas?
They were getting pretty way. This is all happening way up, very very high on Everest, and oxygen was running out. I think they wouldn't have had any by later in the day. And so it was, they were in great danger as well. We were worrying about Lincoln dying, but we knew that it could well be that they'd die as well.
And so what decision did they have to take eventually?
It was about 7:30 at night. We were getting the message that Lincoln was about to die. He was breathing very rarely. And the Sherpas poked him in the eye, and no reaction. And a little while after that, we were told that we kind of knew Lincoln would die, because people do, if you have cerebral edema at that height, people do die. It's just about inevitable.
Because it's so hard for them to get down, or
yes,
you can't get a helicopter up there.
They can't get a helicopter anywhere near that height. So we were starting to worry about, we had one inevitable death, but the Sherpas could well die as well. So we kind of said the Sherpas must come down, and we had been told that Lincoln had actually died. So the Sherpas left him with not much at all, they saved their own lives, and Lincoln was, I had to phone Lincoln's wife to say he died.
You had to do that.
Mm. She had been aware. She had been told earlier that there was a problem. So, and I guess she knew as well as I did that it could end like this.
Then the next morning, you received some other news.
The amazing thing was that another climbing team came up the next morning and suddenly came upon Lincoln alive. He was just alive, in a sense. He was in the last stage of hypothermia. He was taking his clothes off, which happens in the last stage of hypothermia. He was rocking right on the edge of a precipice, thinking he was on a boat, still delusional, but he was alive. And those guys, they like the Good Samaritan, they decided to stay with him and abandon their own climb of Everest. So they gave him their food, their water. They didn't, and they radioed down to our team to say Lincoln was alive.
Could you believe it when you got that news?
We actually didn't get it till about tonight, the next night, because we had left base camp as planned, knowing that Lincoln was dead, and it was just amazing to get that news.
And then, how did he get down from the top of Everest?
More people came up, and he was still, in a sense, reluctant to come down. But he saved himself by the fact that he was still strong enough to walk. It's very, very hard to rescue anybody.
Because you can't carry someone.
It's just so hard to just be there yourself to carry anybody else. It just doesn't happen. So he was slowly brought down to the lower altitude and given oxygen, and he did come good. He frostbite, of course. He got frostbite, but he was alive.
When did you first see him after this resurrection?
I came back with the Nepalese, the Australian ambassador to the Tibetan border, and met him there. And it's pretty special. His wife flew over and we
did you get to call her to say?
It wasn't me that was able to call her. But but anyway, the fact is somebody did, and that was great.
What sort of physical state was he in then? Is it something that you recover from quickly, this kind of intense altitude sickness?
No, it was, he took a while. He was still a bit delusional even over those last few days, but he came good mentally, but the frostbite, he had amputations to some of his fingers.
All this time that you've spent in and around Everest, Michael, you've never reached the summit yourself, though?
No.
Does that bug you? Do you want to do it?
I would like to. Yeah, I would like to walk that last little bit to the summit and see the view. But I'm happy enough. I think that it probably won't happen. And just to be there and be amongst the Sherpa people, and it's more to the Everest experience than just reaching the summit.
You first went to Everest in the late 60s. How much has that place changed in the intervening decades?
When we first went, there were absolutely no tourist facilities there, no tea houses or anything. But there are now. But if you look at most villages, you don't really notice too much change, as all the tea houses and the extra buildings have been built in the same architectural style. The people, less of them there, because sadly a lot of Sherpas have had to move away. There are quite a few in America now, but they have maintained the villages because of the trekking. That is the main industry now that keeps them in their villages. Because they used to be mountaineers, they used to be traders before that, but that all stopped with the closure of the Tibetan border. And so tourism does, in a sense, keep the villages active and alive.
Do the numbers of climbers, because there's been such an explosion in numbers of climbers, does that affect your experience of the grandeur of those peaks?
I think they are so grand that it doesn't affect it that much. You've probably seen lions on the certain days on Everest that, when in the peak Everest season in a good year, many, many people can be seen on the same rope going for the summit. But it is such a huge, big, vast, beautiful area that I don't think it's been spoilt much by anything we've done.
Have you got plans to go back?
Well, we're going back. I'm involved in the Australian Himalayan Foundation, which is really just continuing Hilary's work with teacher training and so on. So I'm leading a trek to base camp to kind of raise more money for the Himalayan Foundation and to help the Nepalese who've had this, really disastrous earthquake.
How much has that earthquake affected the communities that you came to know when you were working with Edmund Hillary?
There's been a lot of damage to various private houses, but also to lots of school buildings. So there's a lot of work still to be done too. I think 30,000 school rooms in the whole of Nepal were damaged by the earthquake.
And what about the impact on the whole trekking industry?
People are worried that there might be another earthquake, but actually it doesn't happen too much, because there's normally a big earthquake every 100 years. It's happened now. So it's fine from that point of view. But yeah, people are scared to go back to Nepal right now, which is rather sad, because they really need the tourists to get on their feet again.
Will you be bringing your camera with you when you go?
Of course. I always have my little camera. Yeah, I can't live without my camera around my neck.
But it's a little camera now, is it?
It's a little camera, thank goodness.
Michael, thanks so much for coming on. I feel like I've had an adventure just speaking with you.
Thanks, Sarah.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.